Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me as we finally get this week over with. I'm John DeRoll. This is David Fort, and it's Friday. And so we're joined once again by Brett Ehrlich.
I've been told by JR that I need to market my appearances on this show better, similar
to
JR Fridays. You know, or JR Wednesdays.
He's apparently not doing good enough marketing because you don't even know what it is.
So JR Wednesdays, and Brooke apparently is doing something. Not familiar with her work.
I wasn't. Jesus. Brooke blowing up on Twitter, by the way. Go check that out.
So speaking of me, I think, what do you think? What do you think we should call it? Brett's Days.
I had not thought
freaky
about it.
Get Freaky Fridays with Brett. My name isn't like fun.
It doesn't fit with it necessarily, but okay, we're gonna come up with something. I don't have anything right now.
Get aroused this morning. Started off right with Brett.
Well, let's get all the bad ones out of the way first, and then we can start to come up with something good. Anyway, what we will have might not be a cool moniker for his Friday appearances, but we will have is the news. And so we're gonna be starting off just a little bit with some updates on Facebook. But then we've got a really major Pentagon report about how much damage climate change is going to do, not just to our country, but more importantly to our military. Turns out it's gonna be pretty bad. And then how is Donald Trump approaching the news in his reelection bid? Very interesting developments there with reporting by the Daily Beast. And then this Democratic primary electorate, we've got a lot of candidates, but could we possibly have one more? Is one lurking in the background waiting to pounce? We're gonna talk about that in a little bit. And what would happen if that person did enter the primary? But before all of that, let's touch base with Mark Zuckerberg once again. Today, Facebook has announced the initial alpha rollout of Facebook News, which I'm sure is going to be much better than the way that they've approached news in the past. So Facebook News, if you haven't already seen, is going to offer stories from a mix of publications, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, as well as digital only outlets like BuzzFeed and Business Insider. Some stories will be chosen by a team of professional journalists, while others will be tailored to readers' interests over time using Facebook's machine learning technology, which is also what powers Mark Zuckerberg. And so this is a new platform that they're starting up. It's initially only going to be available to a few people for a period of several months. So if you log on to Facebook, don't expect that you're actually gonna see it right now. But if they like what they see over the next few months, it might roll out. And by the way, importantly, this is not going to change anything about your feed. That is still gonna be the weird mix of, you know, dog photos and conspiracy theories. This is a separate tab specifically for curated news from a list of organizations.
So Facebook does this occasionally where they try to introduce a new product and it either succeeds or fails. So the Messenger app, and a lot of them failed. They had like a Foursquare equivalent for a while that failed. And their Messenger app, they've tried to really make happen. And so that's what this is. And usually it's a version of someone else's thing that exists already. So this
stories
they did, stole from Snapchat, but like Google and like even the status bar and the Twitter timeline. But Google News is a thing. Google News does this exact same thing. And I suggested back in the day that, like probably a couple years ago, that when all of this started being a problem for Facebook, that they start doing something like this. That they
talking about fake news being a problem.
Yeah, that they just say here's your news. That's it. Yeah. But I have the Google News feed, and it is a mix of here are the big trending stories, and I think that will do. I mean, I just found out about this, but like it will do a certain amount of lifting if it does become ubiquitous enough across the site and for among users in their typical Facebook experience. It will do something towards saying, you know, people who come to Facebook expecting every news article on it to be real.
Yeah.
This actually will give you some real actual news if it's done right versus what happens now, which is you just go through your feed and you
it
get
be
things,
anything.
You get things that look like news, but that is how literally how fake news, when the term was used accurately, began.
Yeah, so look, I have some thoughts about how this might actually work in practice, but before that, you raised the possibility that if this is done right, there is a reason to think that it might not be done right, or at least not done perfectly. So let me give you some more details, and we'll get into the first big initial problem. Facebook is going to pay for a range of content from dozens of publishers, including some deals that are multi-million dollar deals. Also local news from smaller publishers in areas like Dallas, Fort Worth, Miami, and Atlanta. That actually is fine. I'm saying getting the local news.
Right, but local news apparatuses are typically part of a larger like multimedia or media conglomerate that controls what they do. Mm. So just saying that they're going to get their local news from Dallas-Fort Worth isn't enough.
It's not enough if you're saying that that makes it necessarily like authentic or verifiable, but at least it will let people get a wide range of news from across not just the country, but from their area.
The reason I say that is typically when Facebook rolls something new out, they go, hey, we've covered a base. You should love it.
Yeah.
The same thing we heard from Zuckerberg when he was in the hearing and said, well, we have an independent news fact-checking site. But AOC points out Daily Caller's on it. Doesn't that not pass the sniff test?
That's actually where we get into one of the problems. Very similar thing to what AOC was doing. Before we get to that though, Zuckerberg put out a statement about this, said, we feel acute responsibility because there's obviously an awareness that the internet has disrupted the news industry business model. We figured out a different way to do this that we think is going to be better and more sustainable.
It's still Google News, dude.
It is effectively. And yeah, like you said, they keep adding things from other platforms. And honestly, does anyone think that good. They've added all these features over the past few years and Facebook is better than it used to be. I honestly could not give you three reasons why I'm still on it other than inertia, I guess. But in any event, what's interesting about this is that as of just last year, Rupert Murdoch was putting pressure on Mark Zuckerberg to pay Fox and conceivably others. I'm sure Murdoch was only interested in Fox being paid for their content. And Zuckerberg said he wasn't remotely interested in that. And less than a year later, or maybe a year and change later, he has completely flipped and now is not just paying them, but has this whole service that is designed around paying a number of different publishers of news. And is that the result of more pressure behind the scenes? I don't know, but it's a 180 in just a year. But anyway, the big issue is not that New York Times and Washington Post are going to get paid by Facebook to spread their news. If that helps them to stay fiscally good, I'm fine with that. It's that another Facebook news partner is Breitbart, the far-right digital publisher. Unlike the Times, the Washington Post, and several other paid partners, Breitbart will not be paid, at least initially. And the problem with that is not that Breitbart is right-wing, it's that Breitbart is... It's been normalized over the past few years, I guess, because Donald Trump is president. He takes him seriously.
No, here's why. It's because the nature of Facebook is one where if something's wrong with Facebook, they're afraid people will stop using Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that's different from if something's wrong with the New York Times, people stop reading the New York Times, fine. But the New York Times isn't a larger company that does other stuff. Mm-hmm. Facebook, in launching Facebook News, is like, all right, we want to solve problem A, but we don't want to give ourselves problem B. Problem B would be if we started Facebook News and kept right-wing news outlets out of the picture, right-wingers will stop using Facebook altogether, or conservative-leaning people who hear the eventual message brought up by Breitbart and everybody saying there's a conservative media bias. Mm-hmm. They're afraid they're gonna drive their largest growing user base was just conservatives over 65 off of Facebook.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And that problem is one of too large a company mm-hmm. with too many irons in the fire. It's the problem with something that's that big that needs to be broken up into smaller companies.
Yeah. Look, I don't even know if it would drive them off. I mean, the thing is this is gonna get rolled out to be a separate tab, but your feed is still gonna be the wild west of fake news and sites that are designed to look like CNN but aren't. They're still gonna have that. I don't think most conservatives are gonna be clicking on the news tab. I think they're perfectly happy to just see that feed of people who spread the sort of fake news that they want. But anyway, really fast, for people who aren't very familiar with Breitbart, you are a blessed few. But one of the reasons that people have a problem with it is it's just an out and out white nationalist alt-right website. It has been for a very long time. They've gotten in trouble over the years for doing things you can take a look at this screenshot. This was their section on black on black violence that they had. It was a literal tag that you could search on their website to get stories that give you the black on black violence content that you've been looking for. That's just a normal thing that, news sites do.
Wait, go back to
that. You ever go to the New York Times black on black crime section? Can we say that one more time?
All of the ones above it. FBI framed Flynn, Spygate heats up, Schiff's dungeon, Soros speaks, and then Brexit blocked again.
Yeah, if you want the news, but you don't want to get uncomfortable mentally, even 0.1%, and that's what you just go to Breitbart because they will give you exactly what they want. But anyway, it's been attacked previously. This was back when Steve Bannon was moved from Breitbart to the White House. The ADL put out a statement saying they strongly oppose the appointment of Steve Bannon as senior advisor and chief strategist in the White House. It's a sad day when a man who presided over the premier website of the alt-right, a loose-knit group of white nationalists and unabashed anti-Semites and racists, is slated to be a senior staff member in the People's House. And an expose by BuzzFeed later that year documented how Breitbart had solicited story ideas and copy edits from white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And their site, I think, has shifted more heavily into anti-immigration and anti-Islam. But that's what the site is. It's just, it's like stuff that's come from 4chan or from the dark parts of Reddit or from, you know, these sorts of conspiracy theory havens. And then it's cleaned up a little bit and it looks like it's news kind of, because Breitbart gets to have a person in the White House. And they're going to be one of the trusted news purveyors from a very select elite few that Facebook is going to put their thumbs up on. Man, Breitbart is as official as the New York Times.
It's not getting paid though.
It's not getting paid.
But that's exactly the point.
If you click on it, you will trust it.
But the point is, they're like, but they're not getting paid, right? Do you like me again? And I will say that, like, it is a drastically strange and changing news environment. And that is a difficult problem for Facebook to solve. Mm-hmm. So I understand that they have what they consider to be growing pains along the way. My grave concern is that they don't allow the gravity of concern for the people who are suffering from their mistakes.
Yeah.
Which is the discourse in the universe, essentially.
Yeah, they're focusing on, we've gotten attacked, we've gotten pressured, I'm gonna come up with a solution because we're suffering, not what are people's actual concerns about? Not as is Tucker Carlson telling me that I'm not being fair to him, but really, what is misinformation doing to the American voter?
Yeah.
Which is far more important. But Zuckerberg apparently doesn't have that concern.
And just last thing, we need to keep the pressure up because the right is keeping the pressure up on Zuckerberg. And as much as he doesn't like it, he is taking meetings with them.
Exactly.
So we need to kick and scream more than they do because we're better.
Okay, we'll end on that. Okay, we do have to take a break. We come back, guests gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
About 3 weeks ago, President Trump signed into law the Autism Cares Act, lending several $1 billion in support to people on the autism spectrum and their families. And joining us now to talk about this law, what it does, and where we could go from here is Areva Martin, CNN contributor and legal analyst. Areva, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm very glad to talk to you about this topic. And so I didn't see a lot of news about this law when it was passed. I think a lot of people might be unfamiliar with it. Can you basically summarize what the Autism Cares Act is designed to do?
Yeah, you're so correct, John, in that it got buried in all the political news because there's so much going on in Washington. But this is a really big deal. $1.8 billion have been allocated from the U.S. government. The money primarily will go to the Center for Disease Control and the National Institute of Health. And the thought behind this is that over a five-year period, these two organizations will receive the bulk of this money. And the money is to be used to address both research-related issues and to get the money into communities that have been particularly underserved, as well as populations in the autism community that have been underserved. There's some specific language in the law about reaching adults who are chronically underserved, and then helping the families that care for individuals with autism. So this is a really big deal for the autism community, and I just want to thank you and your team for, you know, talking about it, because it should be talked about, and families need to know that the law was passed, that the funds have been appropriated through Congress, and that there's hope for a lot of families that often struggle getting the resources that they need.
Yeah. So when you hear a number like $1.8 billion, absent context, that seems like an incredible amount of money, but it does need to be put into context. And I honestly, I don't know. Activists in this area, researchers in this area, have they responded to this bill by saying $1.8 billion is, you know, is in line with what is needed to accomplish their goals? How is the reception to the bill being passed been?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think the bill has been caught up in some of the political partisanship that we see on so much that comes out of Washington, D.C. I think there's a lot of skepticism, particularly in African American, Latino, and minority communities. Those communities have been woefully underserved when it comes to funding. I live in the state of California, and some of the work that I do, a lot of the work that I do is in California, and we've had huge disparities in governmental spending as it relates to autism treatment, diagnosis, and care, a lot of it based on zip codes where people actually live. So I think the reception has been muted. It's been, you know, kind of a reserved reception. People are happy about it on one hand, but then there's this concern, how does that money get into communities that really need it? Yeah. National Institute of Health, as you know, is this massive health organization. So what we're hoping doesn't happen is that most of that money ends up in research. Research is important, but also day-to-day services, those things that help individuals with autism, you know, have a better quality of life. So we're hoping, and it's not really clear yet. I've had my team, you know, I am the founder and president of a nonprofit special needs network. So I've had my team start to investigate, how does community-based organizations, how do organizations like mine all over this country, you know, access some of those funds. And to be honest with you, we haven't figured that out as of yet. But I encourage anyone that's listening to this, you know, talk to your local congressperson, talk to individuals in your state government, you know, because they should be helping coordinate how those funds get into the hands of people on the ground.
Certainly, certainly. And so I'm also interested in where do we go from here? The bill got passed, which stands out because it seems to be doing a pretty good job, and also because virtually nothing gets passed these days, so it's noteworthy for that reason.
Absolutely.
But also in terms of other things that could be done. So we saw that presidential candidate Andrew Yang, whose son is also on the spectrum, he talks about his universal basic income proposal as a way to value the work of people like his wife, who stays home and, you know, is there for his son. So that's one idea. So I'm curious about your thoughts about that. But then outside of that, what are some other efforts that can be undertaken in this area?
Well, first of all, I want to just say thank you and congratulate Andrew Yang for making the issue of autism so prominent in his campaign. Because when we have high profile people like someone running for office of president talk about issues of disabilities, talk about things like autism and other related developmental disorders, it matters. Having those conversations, similar Senator Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and some of the other presidential candidates as well have been talking a lot about the disability community and disability rights. So I think we start by having the conversations, elevating the conversation, making the conversation around people with disabilities a national conversation. I like that Andrew Yang is talking about universal income. He is so correct that many, many, typically mothers, do quit their jobs to care for their children on the autism spectrum, primarily because the care is so intensive and so involved. It involves, you know, lots of medical appointments, appointments with school districts, appointments with therapists. And some families find it impossible for a parent to be involved and to provide the kind of care that a child needs while maintaining a full-time job. Yeah. So just valuing the work that parents do who care for individuals with autism, I think is a really important thing to do in this country. Making the laws more flexible in terms of work, providing paid leave for family members who need to take time off to care for an individual with autism is also something that I think we should be looking at in this country. And I hope all of the candidates running for office will consider. Parents need more time to care for kids. One thing I can tell you, I'm a mom of a son on the spectrum. So I know this as an advocate, I know as a civil rights lawyer, I know it as a parent. Our kids are incredibly, incredibly capable of learning and living productive lives, but they've got to get early diagnosis, early intervention, and they've got to have a community around them that provides the kind of supports they need to thrive. So I think as a nation, we need to think about how we value the lives of those with disabilities, not think of them as a burden or as people that can't be productive, but think about them as individuals who have tremendous capabilities to be tax-paying, law-abiding, productive members of our society.
I couldn't agree more. Reva Martin, founder of the nonprofit Special Needs Network, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks, John.
We're gonna take a short break. We'll see you on the other side. What has been fascinating is that even as Donald Trump and the official position of the US government is that climate change is a giant hoax manufactured in China, one really important part of the US government is and always has taken climate change very seriously, and that is the US military. There's a new report that I just read the results of that are fascinating. And you should definitely go take a look at the raw report, but even the headline version of it is something. So understand, this was put together with involvement from the Army, the DIA, NASA, and it was commissioned by General Mark Milley, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So it's coming from inside the deep state. But anyway, the report paints a frightening portrait of a country falling apart over the next two decades due to the impacts of climate change on, quote, natural systems such as oceans, lakes, rivers, groundwater, reefs, and forests. And it talks about increased energy requirements triggered by new weather patterns like extended periods of heat, drought, and cold that could eventually overwhelm an already fragile system. And this is not just like, hey, look ahead to two decades from now and imagine what might happen. Here in California, we just had huge power outages, not as a result of something being taken down by nature. It was like a preemptive thing. We need to take this down, you're gonna lose power in anticipation. And so that's the sort of thing that's being talked about here, but it's already happening right now.
Yes, it's after careful consideration, I have concluded that climate change is man-made and a disaster in the making.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it's like, because it's funny, what you just mentioned, that sounds like some kind of post-apocalyptic situation or scenario, or at least like that scene before the giant problem that ends up making it really like the apocalypse, I guess, where people are like, this is the incremental nature of what we are to experience that will then suddenly we'll look back and be like, oh my God, that was terrible. I wish we'd done something about it.
Yeah, yeah, someday we'll say that. Yeah, and again, as we always try to stress, this is about the future, but it is not something that is going to start someday. We're in it right now. This is sketching out how it's gonna get worse. So, really importantly, our infrastructure in almost every area in this country is much worse than you've been led to believe. Especially when it comes to our electrical grid. It is already fragile. That's how the US military describes it. So if that was to be overwhelmed by a period of drought or extreme heat, it was overwhelmed, what sort of bad effects could that have? Well, they were able to identify a few. That's a loss of perishable foods and medications, loss of water and wastewater distribution systems, loss of heating and air conditioning and electrical lighting systems, loss of computer, telephone, and communication systems, loss of public, what's that?
I would just love it. It's like, here's things that run on electricity.
Everything. Loss of public transportation systems, loss of fuel distribution systems and fuel pipelines, loss of all electrical systems that do not have backup power. Obviously, most important there is that you'd lose the internet and your phone service. So other than that, you'd be fine. No, but that's significant. The ability to distribute fuel, food could be lost. I mean, that's
takeaway for me. Stuff. This is a very, let me put this in terms that you'll understand to people on the right. That's what this is to me. Because everyone on the left, every decent person who believe, who reads science, or at least like believes scientists, and especially like the vast majority of them that say the same things we say over and over again, it feels like you're hitting your head against the wall. We get it. But for people who are still climate science skeptics, this is something that you should really understand.
Yeah.
Like our military is saying that our military, which requires all those things, I'm sure they'll go into detail in a bit, but all those things that keep us safe, that keep us secure, that keep our troops fed in remote locations where they are fighting for your freedom, those things will go away. So if you don't support common sense legislation, albeit sweeping, to fight the effects of climate change, then you hate the troops.
Yeah, or you certainly don't support them, not in any way that matters to them.
No, you want them to suffer and die of malnourishment in deserts,
and
which
by the
are
way,
growing.
When air, if the environmental situation is so bad that it kills our electrical grid and air conditioning goes down in one of these areas, what do you think is the likely impact of that? If the heat is so bad it's killed our electricity, that seems like exactly the sort of time that you need air conditioning. We're talking about people dying. If the food is taken away, refrigeration spoils, people will starve. That's what happens. The fuels obviously makes it more difficult to actually respond to that. But this is all, like, the tragedy here is that global climate change refuses to pick up a gun and point it at us, because that is the only way that some people will acknowledge the threat that it poses. But these same people who are willing to spend trillions of dollars sending the military abroad because they believe it will help keep us safe will not do what is necessary to stop us from dying of heat exposure, dying of starvation, all of these things that the US military is saying this is coming.
I disagree with some of your rhetoric there, John, because if the climate did pick up a gun and point it at us, then I think Republicans would respect it more and support its right to threaten us with death. It's just standing its ground, John.
That's true. And so, by the way, this is not just the military saying you guys are all screwed. They're also saying, hey, by the way, I'm screwed. The report warns that the US military itself could end up effectively collapsing as it tries to respond to climate collapse. It could lose capacity to contain threats in the US and could wilt into mission failure abroad due to inadequate water supplies. The study called on the Pentagon to urgently prepare for the possibility that domestic power, water, and food systems might collapse due to the impacts of climate change as we near mid-century. And if you read the full report, they'll also describe how the situation in Syria that we got embroiled in, we've already explained a million times how it's related to climate change. If you don't accept that, I'm not going to try to persuade you at this point. But that sort of conflict will become far more common. They specifically sketch out what could happen with Bangladesh, and they talk about how the same thing that happened in Syria, where a huge percentage of the population eventually moved out of its borders. That could happen in a country with a far larger population. And it's difficult to imagine how much strain that would put on surrounding countries.
Right, and this is a way of pitching the Green New Deal as a way to help the military. This is also, I just think it's kind of an insurance policy against climate change. This is something that, and then also like the reason that our infrastructure cannot handle these kinds of upsurges, which will be, or you know, increased demands on it as a result of climate change, is because we were able to build it at a time when we could financially do that because we had a better incremental tax system. And that has gone. And I just want to make America great again. So let's go back to that tax system where we could afford electricity.
I see what you're doing there.
Thank you.
I see what you're doing. Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Donald Trump, how is he responding to the impeachment pressure that he's under? How is he viewing different sources of news? We'll get into that after this. So how is Donald Trump reacting to this new pressure? Well, he's changing his approach to the news. And the best way that I saw this summed up was one, albeit anonymous, senior White House official said that he is making a defensive barrier between himself and news that doesn't, quote, make him feel beautiful and powerful. That was a person who works for him who said that. But anyway, what does that mean in practice? Well, it means a few different things. You might have seen in the news this week. On Thursday, the Wall Street Journal reported the White House planned to order federal agencies to stop renewing subscriptions to the Washington Post and the New York Times. This comes after earlier this week, he canceled the not the online version, but at least the in-print version of those things coming to the White House. But what's interesting about that is that people who work with him say that even though he seems like the sort of person who's never read more than a picture book in his life, supposedly for years he does read newspapers every day. He doesn't learn anything, but he reads them. And they said it's such an ingrained habit that he's going to end up asking for copies to be delivered, that he's going to come to hate this move that he's made.
He's triggered by a masthead. Mm-hmm. He's triggered by the mere sight of the New York Times.
Yeah.
So he's not only canceling his New York Times subscription, he is commissioning the digging of holes in the sand for him to bury his head in. That's what this is. This is so fragile.
Yeah.
I don't understand how anyone can look at his behavior and say, here's a strong guy.
Alpha male.
I need to get rid of my subscriptions. I'm afraid of mastheads. I don't want to see what the paper is or who works for it. And do you think he actually read those articles? No.
They're saying that he did. I mean, look, I'm trying to correct my own bias. I would assume that he doesn't read it all.
No.
Supposedly he does.
He likes to sit at a wingback chair and just go like this. Just the crackle of it.
Because he's seen businessmen do it on movies?
Because that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And maybe he has the Wall Street Journal. Businessmen read the journal. He also probably sees the headlines and he likes the ritual. There's tons of people
who can be fun.
No, not many people read the entire paper.
No, of course not. Does he get it ironed? Because I saw that in Downton Abbey and it seems very fancy. I'm not sure. So that's what's going on with the actual newspapers. He's created a safe space.
John wants you to know he watches Downton Abbey. He's cultured.
No. I want you to know that I watched the first episode of Downton Abbey where that scene appears and then I moved on.
I tried many times to get through it. I could not.
I watched it because I heard that there were a lot of Game of Thrones people on it, but not in the first episode. And that's as much of an investment as I can commit.
But I didn't cancel my subscription to Netflix where it was for a while.
Definitely not. I got to find out what happens in the last episode of Rhythm and Flow. But anyway, so we're gonna move forward. That's one type of media, which I would describe as the media. But there's a different type, and this he's more interested in. So on Wednesday, Tommy Lauren tweeted a photo of a sheet of paper the president had signed thanking her for everything. The page labeled Reactions to President Trump's Rally in Dallas, Texas was a compilation of tweets. And they mean that literally. The page was a bunch of screenshotted tweets on one piece of paper. And we find out more about this thanks to the reporting by the Daily Beast. The autographed piece of paper the Fox Nation host received is actually the result of a long-standing demand that Trump has made of his aides. Following a MAGA rally, staff began compiling packets, which would sometimes stretch numerous pages exclusively displaying tweets about the rally Trump had just headlined. Trump became so accustomed to these pages that, according to a source familiar with the matter, he would complain to senior aides if he didn't have the packet of Twitter posts in hand to read over within 20 minutes of the campaign rally ending. And look, that's weird. True, but it gets a little bit sad. One senior administration official was quoted as saying, "It remains to this day a source of joy for the president. He will sometimes wave the post-rally printouts around, talking about how much people love him and what a great job he did. It's often someone from Fox or some guy from the internet tweeting about the president."
Do you know who that guy was on that one of the people on this printout of Tommy Lauren? Chuck Woolery.
Really?
Yes. Mm. Chuck Woolery, and then some guy from the internet, and then the GOP just randomly like quote tweeting one line from his speech. Mm-hmm. This is so pathetic. Not just, like, think of the entire breadth of it. One, he needs this obvious, he needs the praise. He needs to see it immediately. He waves it around, it's so good. Mm-hmm. But two, he can't, the same way he can't see the New York Times, he also can't just pull out his Twitter feed and scroll through the comments.
But
because when he does that, it's going to be the negative comments too.
Yeah.
So he needs someone to go through and, again, bury his head in the sand and insulate him completely from any negative reinforcement because it triggers him so.
Yeah, so look, I would say I understand how negative the internet can be.
Yeah.
And you are under no obligation to open up the core nexus of your brain to the unbridled insanity of the internet. But you're also, like, you probably shouldn't have a tweeted out list that you wave around like a kid who just got a balloon. Like, that's weird too.
But the problem is his rhetoric and the changing nature of the news media kind of allows everyone to do this, and they're
to very carefully select what emotional experience they get.
Yes, to to if all they want to do is weed out anything that refutes any instinct that they might have.
Yeah.
And any other information out there. It's that it, they he wants he has he, he's able to make the world this way. Mm-hmm. He Fox News and a lot of his supporters are trying to have the exact same experience. They just can't afford aides to go find and print out all the positive yeah. tweets because the tax cut didn't apply to them.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine what version of this would be acceptable. Maybe if it was like interesting perspectives compilated into a page or criticisms that seem to come from a place of wanting this person to be better. Here are things to consider to change. That could be useful. He's not going to get any of that. Just getting the praise is weird. And whatever definition of alpha male you have, if it incorporates this, it's a useless definition. Doesn't mean anything.
No, he's doing it. He's like alpha male applies to dogs typically. but like he's more of like a good little puppy.
Yeah.
He does it because he wants a treat. Yeah. This is his little treat.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I get it. So the final thing I want to talk about in terms of the media is his approach to interviews. So back during the 2016 election, he was all over the news, always. He was on Fox News a ton, sure. But he was on Morning Joe, like every morning for what felt like 17 years or so. Mm-hmm. And so he was spreading it around everywhere because he wanted to overwhelm the news. And it 100% worked. I don't like him to be there.
I want to Photoshop that real bad. Sorry. Continue.
Anyway, he wanted to be all over the news, and it worked. And I think he probably won the primary in no small part because he was all over the news. Well, his approach right now apparently is, I'm not interested in that anymore. I'm not doing CNN, I'm not doing MSNBC. I want to be on Fox News. He's doing more and more interviews with Sean Hannity and all of that recently. And he said about these other places, why would I give them the best ratings they've ever had when they've been this nasty and so corrupt, so vile? So this I only bring up because it does mark a changing campaign strategy that, if he's consistent on it, could have an effect in this reelection bid.
Yeah, I mean, but that's just more of the same. Him trying to only cater to a base by giving little drops of information that that reinforce whatever his strategy was. But yeah. What's hilarious about this is that the impeachment inquiry is little drops of information in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And the difference between the drops of information from the impeachment inquiry and the drops of information from Trump to Fox News is the impeachment inquiry. Those are all actual facts.
That is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we're gonna take a short break. We come back. The Democratic primary field, could it get one bigger? We'll break it down after this. I think most people can take a look out at the slate of candidates we have in this Democratic primary and think, yeah, that's probably enough. That's a lot of people on the stage at once. But that field might actually still get bigger. There are rumblings about a few different people, and I don't want to necessarily put it out in the universe, but one of them, Hillary Clinton, isn't necessarily not getting into this. Now, this all started thanks to, it seems, Donald Trump, who a little while back tweeted, I think that crooked Hillary Clinton should enter the race to try and steal it away from Uber left Elizabeth Warren. Only one condition, that's all just conspiracy theories at that point. But so he tweeted that, which is one thing to do. But the scary thing was the response from Hillary Clinton, who tweeted, don't tempt me, do your job. Don't tweet that. That's mean. Why do that to us? And anyway, you might be able to write that off as saying, she's trying to be clever. She's effectively like, doing that on Twitter or whatever. But it's not just her. So one of her senior advisors, Philip Rhines, he was on Tucker Carlson, this week, said she ran for president because she thought she would be the better president. If she still thought that now, if she thought she had the best odds of beating Donald Trump, I think she would talk about it long and hard. Carlson responds, she hasn't foreclosed the possibility, I guess. And Ryan says, no, she has not.
Think about it long and hard, but yes. Good God. I mean, don't. Just don't. And there's so many reasons why. Like, you're not helping. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not, nothing she's doing right now is helping. So that seems to be more about her own personal interests than it is about getting the world to become a better place again.
Mm-hmm.
We already did it. It doesn't really happen a lot. You don't go back.
You mean
back
her running?
It.
We already
she
did
want,
that.
Who does she want to be? Friggin' Adlai Stevenson and just mm-hmm. keep losing? Like, is that?
Biden has run multiple times.
Adlai Stevenson lost like noble reasons-ish, you could argue. Like, yeah. The world's most lovable, noble loser. I don't know. I've I don't remember it. I studied in college, but like you this isn't helping. She and it would be one thing if the tweets were good, actually. And when I heard her in my mind as she's reading it, it felt like it motivated enough people in a way that was different than who she motivated last time. But this is the same as it would people that it would motivate last time.
Probably less.
And that wasn't enough. Probably less because people are a little upset that she wasn't able to actually pull it off the first time around.
Yeah, look, I get that she's mad about what happened. Mm-hmm. Okay, she feels like she was robbed for one of, you know, a bunch of different reasons or whatever. And she probably every single day she's thought, what if I had won? What would be happening now if it wasn't Trump, if it was me? Fine, you can have those feelings. She's gonna have them for the rest of her life. She's going to be bitter and resentful, and she's allowed to be bitter and resentful. But don't hurt the rest of us by coming back in. And honestly, like she's, you know, Secretary of State, former senator, former first lady. Like if she wants to say anything about what's going on, she gets to. But I don't think it helps. Every time she weighs in, I think it hurts the movement. Her attacks against Tulsi Gabbard were counterproductive.
So weird.
At best.
So weird. Because what's her,
stay out of
if
it.
Her intention was to make it so that Tulsi Gabbard wasn't relevant. Mm-hmm. The last thing she should do is mention her in that podcast.
100%.
Like, cause
and that's
like,
why most of the other competitors in the Democratic primary don't talk about her.
And the thrust of that was trying not to jeopardize the potential of a Democratic challenger in the general election. You would do that.
Yes.
You already lost this. And he knows how to beat you. And people didn't show up because it was you.
Yeah.
And no one really was, there weren't a lot of people that were like, I need to get out there for her.
I mean, there were some.
There were
I guess.
Plenty, but it was, but it's just we've run that race.
We've already done it. We don't need to do it again. And look, let's say best case scenario. Let's say that she has a genuine lifelong desire to make this country better, okay? If you doing something can make it better, it's on you. It's your responsibility to do that. But it's also your intellectual responsibility to look at the situation we're in and acknowledge if your inaction actually gets us there better. If it's more productive for you to step out of it, to not constantly be weighing in. Like Barack Obama doesn't tweet about the politics every day, about what's going on in the news, because he knows it would be counterproductive. It would take the focus off the Democratic primary contenders and put it onto him.
And he also beat you.
And he also beat you. So he would know, really. And so here's the good news. That's the bad news. And I want to give you a poll related to this in just a sec. But as this has been going around, as she had her quote, as the former advisors out there like, hey, what do you guys think? Some of her former supporters in elected politics are not so interested in it. So Dick Durbin said, she's done a great service to our country and public service, and I support her wholeheartedly, but I believe it's time for another nominee. John Tester said, I don't think it would be good for her. She's been through this war once. The Republicans have made a target out of her for 30 years, and she's still going to be that same target. I just think it would be tough. Maisie Hirono said, we have a lot of really fantastic candidates out there already. Let's leave it at that. And Joe Manchin said, absolutely not. If you have lost Joe Manchin, stay out of it. He was like, no.
No, that's not gonna help literally anyone.
Yeah, and it's not like Joe Manchin's like a Bernie bro or anything.
Yeah, right?
If he's not interested, just, and by the way, what I'm asking for here is not for her to not run in the primary. That's obvious. It's also make it 100% crystal clear that you're not going to run. Because I don't want people like some of your lingering supporters thinking, oh, maybe she'll come into this and stuff. We've got great contenders. They represent a bunch of different ideological perspectives on the left and in the center. Choose one of those. You're good. You got a wide range there.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that they're talking about her getting in the race is because of a weird, I mean, I don't even know how to follow the polls anymore with, because there was a CNN poll 2 days ago that said Biden has the biggest lead ever. And then there was another poll yesterday that said that Elizabeth Warren's up by 7.
I know, yeah. So, it's kind of all over the place. So that's why we look at the average.
Let that wobble at least play out, because you do have Biden. How are you decidedly different from Biden among what you perceive to be the moderates in a better way?
Yeah.
That gives you more of an edge in the general election. It comes back to this. Donald Trump, even though what he seems to type is borderline indecipherable, he is an excellent political communicator. And Hillary Clinton is a god-awful political communicator.
Yes.
So she shows up the same way Klobuchar is a terrible political communicator. They all give their little zingers and they wait because they got cackles and giggles when they did their little prep. And it isn't working. You're doing it, but you're doing it to an audience of one, and then you get on the main stage and it doesn't work.
Yeah, and if she got on that debate stage, by the way, she would be savage. She doesn't actually want that. So you're pretty against her. She shouldn't run again. I say she shouldn't run again. But much more importantly, let's turn to my Twitter followers. Should she run again? 16% of you said yes. 21% of you said no. That still leaves a lot, obviously. That's because 63% of you said hell no, and that's with more than 7,000 votes. So Hillary Clinton, I'm sorry,
it's
but you
science.
Can take that to the bank. Okay, thank you everybody for watching throughout the week. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.